I call the Senate Health and Social Services Committee to order. Today is Thursday, March 5th, 2026, and the time is 3:30 p.m. Joining me today is Senator Myers and myself, Vice Chair Giesel. I am expecting Senator Klayman shortly. Senator Tobin will also be along. She is presenting a bill elsewhere. And the chairman of this committee, Senator Dunbar, is on the phone joining us. So we do have a somewhat of a quorum to conduct business. Before we begin, thank you, Mayor Gwynn and Chloe, for helping us out, keeping the minutes, and helping us with the audio. Welcome, Senator Klayman. We have two items on the agenda today. We're going to start out with a presentation from the Anchorage Youth Action Board. They are online to present to us. And then we are going to have a second hearing for Senate Bill 193 related to naturopaths. So, first of all, I want to welcome the Anchorage Youth Action Board. And they are online. So will we see their faces soon, do you think, Ariel? Oh, there they are. Thank you. We have this tiny little screen up here. I see you guys now. Hello. Great. So let's see. Here to present today, let's see. We have Jean Gadelia, Shay Morrison, Jason Hunter, Isis Allen, and Zeph Anderson. So who would like to begin? Let's make sure the audio works first. Could you say a few words and we'll see if we got the audio?
Hi, can you hear us?
Oh, yes, loud and clear. Thank you.
Well, hi. First, thank you for having us. My name is Isis. I'm the chair of the Anchorage Youth Action Board. We're really happy to be here. We're really excited to talk to you more about what we do.
Great. If each of you could identify yourself when you speak for the record, that way we'll get your name recorded correctly. And I'll let you go ahead and begin the presentation.
So who we are.
Yes.
So, yes.
Thank you.
So again, my name is Isis. I'm the chair of the Anchorage Youth Action Board. We also call it YAB as well. So our YAB is comprised of people who are around 17 to 25, and these are all youth who have experienced or who are currently experiencing homelessness. And so the meaning of our group is to not only spread awareness of at-risk youth and youth homelessness, but also promote health. And so currently this year, we have our health summit coming up. We're really excited for that. But we wanted to talk more about some problems that not only we have experienced, but we noticed in our community. And we wanted to bring up different solutions to those problems.
Great. We're always interested in solutions.
Yes. Okay, so it's going to be next slide. So the first slide is going to be public benefits are difficult to navigate. And we can go to the next slide. So currently public benefits are difficult to navigate. Not only have I experienced this as someone who was applying for Medicaid and SNAP, but it's been really difficult to not only reach out to providers who are providing that care, but also be able to have a speedy application process. As well as research has found that although 94% of homeless people may have access to cell phone use, only 56% have consistent use to their phones, which make it really hard to not only apply for these services, but continue with the application process. And many of homeless people do not have an address that can be used for those services. Some of the solutions that we have brought up is to modernize and simplify the application and renewal process for SNAP, Medicaid, housing, and other benefits, requiring a mobile-friendly platform with SMS or email notification. Specifically, email would also be great for people who don't have consistent access to phones. They can go to the library and use their email as a way of communication. Allowing flexible verification for people experiencing homelessness, Like we understand, many homeless people do not have consistent address. And having a common place where they can have the address to send their mail to will make the renewal process a lot easier and accessible. The next solution is to require timely notice of interviews and also having an option for phone or video interviews. The last solution is to expand the acceptance of service provider addresses. Next slide.
So for the record, this is Anderson speaking. Problem number two, young people don't know resources until it's too late. You can go to the next slide now. So about 75% of youth and teen have reported that they usually the first person they will go to for support will be teachers or counselors, trusted adults, before they would go to like public services or health. Only roughly nationally about like 58% of teens actually get the support that they need. 2 in 5 teenagers have reported not getting the support they needed, whereas 93% of parents believe otherwise, unfortunately. So we suggest that more schools have an after-school programs would readily have available information like where to get food SNAP applications, Medicaid, housing resources, as well as a domestic violence hotline if there is any turmoil at home as well that they do not feel safe to talk about in person, and possibly even a national information for the National Runaway Hotline.
Very good. I'm a big fan of those items. Are there any questions from committee members? Okay, I don't see any. Yeah, those are I especially like the school and after school programs, especially having behavioral health clinicians in schools. That happens to be a place where I volunteer often, and I understand what you were sharing about parents often not recognizing that students need someone besides the parent to talk to. Good.
Yes.
All right.
For the record, this is Jason Hunter speaking. So problem three, access to resource assistance call lines like 211 are not open 24 hours a day. Many young people are unable to access them during the hours that they are open. Next slide. So 40% of people who call statewide, more than half of 211 callers are below the age of 40. 40% of those callers are between the age of 21 to 40, and 33% of total callers call about housing or shelter support. Our solution to 211 not being readily available for those people is to just fund it to run 24 hours a day. On another note, kind of banking off of what Zeph said, we did recently discover that there are national call lines such as domestic violence, runaway, and we would love to have state local call lines for things such as that.
Yes, you know, the funding the 211 line is a topic here in the legislature, and the question is how to fund it. We're just looking at should there be a fee connected to cell phones and landlines as we have for the 911, but it's complicated. It's not quite that simple. So we are aware that we need those resource lines and we need them to be more available. So thank you for bringing that up. Good. I'll let you go on.
Oh, no, that was it. Next
okay. Slide.
So for the record, this is Isis Allen again. Talking about problem four, And that is that youth have a youth people have a difficult time accessing healthcare. Let me go on to the next slide. So the current issue that we found is that youth, especially at-risk youth or homeless youth, have a very big difficulty in receiving and accessing healthcare. And KFF.org found that in 2024, 12% of Alaskan women ages 18 and older did not see a doctor in 12 months due simply to cost. Researchers also found that 15% of Alaskan women do not have a PCP or personal doctor. And this is just for Alaskan women and doesn't even include homeless youth. And so the worry is that not having timely access to healthcare or having disruption in care through the Medicaid process can increase the risk of health issues and then also increase the cost for Medicaid, for the emergency department, as well as the homeless youth. So some solutions that we found is, again, to simplify the Medicaid enrollment and renewal process for youth, or increase the available resources for youth to reach out to providers who can help them with the process. Ensure a continuous coverage when youth exit OCS or juvenile justice, and giving them more of a buffer time to be able to either continue with Medicaid or find a job that allows them to have health coverage through them. Expanding medical debt relief for low-income youth, and then also requiring state licensed providers to visibly post patient advocacy contacts in common areas so that youth can access them. Next slide.
Before you go on, hold on, before you go on to number five, let's talk about the solutions for number four. So I know that Department of Health is working on simplifying the Medicaid enrollment and renewal. And it's not just youth that are being challenged by it, right? But but I know they're going to keep pursuing that. So that's good. Just this week, we talked with the Office of Children's Services. And for the public who are listening, that's OCS, right? Foster care. And talked with them about their goal of, continuing that coverage after youth exit OCS. So, again, I know people are aware of that problem, too. The medical debt relief, that's an interesting one. We'll have to think about that and how we could fund that. Tell me more about what visibly post patient advocacy contacts means. What are you envisioning with that recommendation? That's the last bullet point.
So when we talk about, for the record, this is ISIS again. So when we talk about visibly posting patient advocacy contacts, that is more to do with accessibility. A lot of times youth might not know the terminology that goes into medical care. So, for example, if they're going to the emergency department and they have questions about getting tested for certain things, or they might have concerns about like social services, do they have the knowledge to be able to ask for that care? So for like hospitals, emergency departments, posting information of, you can call this number, you can reach out to this number if you need a patient advocate, as well as posting it in other hospitals or also in small clinics as well.
Gotcha. Okay. Kind of contact information. And that could also be helpful in just helping youth know what kinds of things are out there. Not only how to contact them, but how they're, you know, one of the things that we're working on here is expanding who the providers are. And what I mean by that is we have legislation we're working on that would allow pharmacists to actually provide basic health care services. So let's say a homeless youth had a sore throat and they were concerned that they were kind of developing a fever. Maybe they had strep throat. They could, with this bill passing, they could go to a pharmacy, and a pharmacist who is actually doctorally educated could do a quick test on their throat, determine if it's strep throat. If it is, the pharmacist then could give them the prescription of antibiotics for that right then and there. Or maybe a homeless woman would say, you know, I think I might have a urinary tract infection. Same scenario. The corner pharmacist could actually take care of them. Right there in the pharmacy, we have pharmacies all over, right? Not so much in rural Alaska, but if we're talking about Anchorage. So this is something we're working on, passing legislation to make that kind of healthcare available.
That would be great. Would it usually be covered, or would it be low cost? So covered through Medicaid or low cost for the individual?
Yes, because you're not going to a big clinic. Right. You're going to the pharmacist at local pharmacist. The cost would be less. And yes, it would be covered by Medicaid. So.
Oh, wow. Great.
Yeah. We think it's pretty great, too. We're trying to get the legislation passed. But that's something we're working on just for access. But I'll let you go on to problem number five.
For the record, this is Jason Hunter speaking. Young people have a difficult time getting and keeping their ID and important documents. Next slide. Our solution to this is to create a free and expedited process for young people experiencing homelessness to get their documents. I know, being homeless myself, I know quite a lot of people who are homeless, and a lot of the obstacles that they have to overcome to get housing and, you know, have a stable job, one of the biggest obstacles that they face is to get, you know, their birth certificate, their all of their documents to be able to even get that job to afford other things. It is quite the problem to overcome when you don't have any way to get income or any way to buy or replace those documents.
Thank you for that. Yes, it is a challenge. I mean, even for people that aren't homeless or youth, it can be a challenge. Any comments from other committee members? All right. This again was a topic that the Office of Children's Services, Foster Care, talked with us about on Tuesday. That as young people are exiting foster care, they often don't have those documents, and they are needed to progress with their life, right, and become go out into the world and get jobs, as you said, and purchase things and whatnot. So thank you for that.
Madam Chair.
Yes. Senator Klayman had a question. Senator Klayman?
More comment than a question. The challenge of documents is not limited to youth. There's lots of folks in our communities that they lost their ID, they lost their Social Security card, and trying to replace that is remarkably challenging. And then there's all kinds of things that you need. You know, sometimes you can't even get a bus pass without an ID, and it's a major challenge. And I understand it's probably even harder for youth because so many of them that are under 18, they need a parent involved. And if they're homeless youth, they may not have such an actively involved parent. So it's a real challenge.
Which makes me think about something else, Senator Klayman, that I want to share with all of you here on the panel. There's another piece of legislation that we're working on that would lower the age of consent for behavioral health services. Right now, you have to be 18 years old. And that's a huge restriction, right, for a youth that are unhoused. So we are attempting to lower the age to 16 so that at age 16, you could go for behavioral health services and consent for them without a parent. Giving that consent as the law requires right now. But, you know, I also think, Senator Klayman, you know, you were talking about, I mean, just the average person doesn't know how to get those documents. Several of the problems you identified before, I'm thinking problem number two, you know, having some kind of access to information about where to go for resources. Getting ID and whatnot could be part of that information that you were referring to earlier. You know, just where do you go to get an ID card and the documents that you need. So these are great suggestions that you're giving us. Okay, so are we up to problem number six?
Yes, next
slide. For the record, I actually would like to make a comment about what you guys are trying to pass. I think that would be.
Could you repeat your name? Could you repeat your name? So. Great.
Zeth Henderson, thank you. I had experienced struggle with getting my medication because my parents did not agree on it and they had to be in agreement. So I actually had to wait until I was 18 years old to be able to get it with my mom. So I think lowering the age of consent for medical practice like that to 16 would be great.
Thanks. You know, youth say that a lot. There are parent organizations, however, that oppose that. So it's always a debate, right? But thank you for that. All right. Are we up to number six now?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
For the record, my name is Gung Gedalia. I'll be addressing problem number six. Many public employees are aging and don't relate to young people. Next slide, please.
We're laughing because we're all old people sitting here. Sorry.
Excuse me.
Yeah, it's all right. We're not taking offense.
Our solution.
Speak for yourself, Madam Chair.
Go ahead.
Our solution to this issue was to create paid peer positions in state agencies that hire and train young adults with lived experience to support peers accessing public benefits. Something like interns or even just assistants, because the director of the DPA union, Heidi Drygrass, had said previously it had hired and retained more DPA workers. It's hard to hire and retain more DPA workers because there's a need to improve conditions, like for, of course, pay benefits, recruitment improvements, and general workplace respect, and to also try and, of course, support less budget cuts to the DPA agency itself. Because there's only 143 on-contract workers, and according to Deb Etheridge, can write down her per position, there's at least going to be at least 60 more required to even feasibly handle the 6,000-plus people who use the DPA system. So obviously there is a need and the youth are willing to fill that need.
That's great. Yeah, Deb Etheridge is the director of the Division of Public Assistance. That's DPA. One of the tips I'll give you when you're presenting, try not to use acronyms. So instead of saying DPA, say Division of Public Assistance. Just a tip for, I mean, we all know the abbreviations you use, like Kaiser Family Foundation, KFF, right? We all kind of recognize those, but just when you're speaking to the public, they wouldn't know what DPA was. But that is a really good, that's a great suggestion to have peer guides, so to speak, through the Division of Public Assistance, and having them be paid positions would be even better, right? But you'd also be learning as you were there, and it'd be a great entry into a job. Good. Mm-hmm. All right, problem number eight.
Or seven.
Are we on seven? I skipped. Pardon me. My handout skipped problem seven. I'm sorry. I don't have a problem.
There is no seven.
Oh, that was a typo on our part.
Okay.
Apologies
good.
For confusion.
Don't worry.
So, yes, Zeth Anderson talking about problem 7/8 because the numbering is wrong. So state agencies and schools are under stress and inconsistent for young people. As I'm sure you guys are probably aware, the Anchorage School District has been hit with some really bad budget cuts, facing a $9 million deficit, which is roughly like $700 per student. The ASD superintendent has called these cuts severe and said the district is already projecting multi-million dollar deficit for the next 2 years. This clearly has caused a lot of issues with being able to properly educate and take care of our students. Our solution is to increase wages, benefits, and retention increase for state and school employees. My fellow Yapper has already discussed a few of the issues that the Department of Public Assistance is suffering, especially struggling with keeping up with a lot of backlogs for food SNAP benefits and Medicaid applications.
Yes, this is one that we're very, very aware of. You know, one of the other things that needs attention with increased money is the IT systems, the computer systems, right? That's another reason that SNAP and Medicaid applications kind of get slowed down. They're using super old computer systems. But your recommendation on wages, benefits, and retention incentive, that actually is something we've been working on now for several years. And again, it's complicated. It does require more funding. And so money's kind of tight right now, and we're working on all of that as well. Any other comments from committee members? Nope. Okay. All right. Then we'll move on to problem number 9.
For the record, this is Shai Morrison speaking. Many young people are having challenging experiences in foster care. Next slide. Some solutions are require regular youth check-ins, increase foster home monitoring, require public reporting on outcomes and incidences, and limit over medication with required second opinion policies.
Very good. Again, these are some things we talked with the Office of Children's Services about just the other day. Senator Myers.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So I'm curious if you could just expand a little bit on the limit over medication. What exactly are you getting at there?
So when I was younger, when I was younger, I was put on medication for my ADHD, and the dosage was far too high, and that severely impacted my life. It made it harder for me to function throughout the day, and I was just overall tired all the time, and it really affected my schoolwork. And these are things that commonly happen where foster parents will push therapists and try to convince them that the psychological disorders these children have are much worse than they actually are.
Follow up, Senator.
And for the record, this is Isis Allen. And what Shai is talking about, they're talking about, is very important. And also, it brings awareness too, is that this can disrupt youth and increase their likelihood of running away from home. And so then they go from being at-risk youth to being homeless youth. So the issue, the concern is that if we're able to fix these problems that we see in foster care, that we can also decrease the amount of youth who run away or become homeless as a result.
Oh, okay, thank you.
Very good. And I completely agree with that recommendation about the over-medication. You know, while I'm a huge advocate for behavioral health, that doesn't include medication. So much positive help can be given through counseling, and drugs don't have to be involved. So I definitely support that one. You know, your second one, increased foster home monitoring. That's one of the things that we put in a recommendation, or was put in a recommendation for the foster care program. And we just heard reports about it on Tuesday. Again, something this committee has been aware of and looking at. So thank you for that one also.
You're welcome.
It looks like that's the end of your presentation.
Mm-hmm. Yes. And for the record, this is Isis. Again, thank you again for having us. We really want to do well in our community and promote awareness of at-risk youth and youth who are homeless. And we thank you all for giving us the time to talk a little bit more about that.
Well, we appreciate you putting together this presentation. It was very thoughtfully done, well presented. Thank you. I know this can be kind of nerve-wracking, but thank you. I'm asking now to pronounce your name, G-E-A-N. Tell me how to pronounce your name.
It is like Gone, like the Jean, but with a G, for Jean.
Oh, so it's like Joan? Well, thank
you. Yeah, like Gone.
Okay. Yes. Well, thank you for presenting. And Shai, Jason, Isis, and Zeph, thank you very much for taking the time to talk to us.
Thank you for hearing.
You're welcome. All right. So we will go on now to our second issue on the agenda today, and that is Senate Bill 193 related to the practice of naturopathy. So I will invite forward Jenna Calhoun. Jenna is staff to Senator Kawasaki, and he is the sponsor of the bill, but is not able to be with us today. So thank you, Jenna, for joining us. And we also have Sylvan Robb. Sylvan, there she is. She's the director of the Division of Corporations, Business and Professional Licensing, and she is in the room to answer questions since this is talking about licensing issues. Welcome, Jenna. If you'd introduce yourself for the record, recap the bill for us, and then we are going to have public testimony today, too.
For the record, Jenna Calhoun, staff to Senator Kawasaki, SB 193, relating to the practice of naturopathy, would allow a naturopathic doctor who's been through 4 years of postgrad studies in an institution accredited by the Council of Naturopathic Medical Education and also took the elective pharmacology examination in the naturopathic physician's licensing examination to be able to prescribe medicine after they have spent 1 year under a supervising physician's collaborative agreement, meaning for a year, this physician would review the prescriptions, and this supervising physician would have to have been prescribing and administering prescriptive drugs for 5 years. Ensure that the committee knows that the naturopathic doctors could not prescribe every type of medicine. They would not be able to prescribe controlled substances, poisons, chemotherapy drugs, antipsychotic drugs, or administer therapeutic ionizing radiation or radioactive substances, nor would this allow them to do any type of surgery, minor surgery either. Currently, 11 other states do allow naturopathic doctors to administer drugs. And with the lack of primary care physicians here in Alaska, this would allow a freedom of choice for our citizens to choose the type of care they would like. And it would prevent them from having to do costly double appointments where they go to their naturopathic doctor, they diagnosed an issue, and then they would have to go to a second primary care physician to get a prescription. This would cut healthcare costs for Alaskans and prevent congestion in the healthcare system here in our state.
Very good, Jenna. Anyone have questions for Jenna? Okay. You know, Jenna, one of the things I think it's important to remember is that there are lots of people in our state that will never go to an allopathic provider, right? They will always go to a naturopath. Those same people develop high blood pressure, develop diabetes. So naturopaths have to be able to treat those folks too, because they're never going to decide, they're never going to feel comfortable going to an allopathic doctor. So it really does serve the population to have this kind of practice allowed. In any case, thank you for that. This committee has no questions, no questions for Director Rob either. Okay, not at this time. Great. Well, at this time, then, I'm going to open public testimony. I always like to start in the room because folks have made the effort to come here and be here in person. And so I see Bethany Buchanan is here in the room wishing to testify. Ms. Buchanan, I would invite you forward. If you would introduce yourself for the record and then give us your testimony. And I think what I'll do is limit testimony to the usual 2 minutes.
Madam Chair, well, the last time I testified before this body was about 8 years ago in support of legislation for PFAS chemicals and de-icing fluids. In the course of explaining their endocrine disrupting effects, I explained their association with precocious puberty in girls and small penis development in boys, and apparently mentioning male genitalia created quite a stir. So today's testimony will be much less stirring. I am in Juneau on behalf of the APRN Alliance and want to thank everyone who is here in this room for meeting with us and listening to our issues yesterday. Today, though, I am here of my own accord, and it should be noted that the Alliance has taken a neutral stance on this bill. My background as a family nurse practitioner includes a specialty of integrative medicine. I have been in independent practice since the late 90s, and in 2002, I co-founded Avante Medical Center and am still employed there even though I'm no longer an owner. Avante is a successful integrative primary care clinic in Anchorage serving thousands of patients a year. What makes my testimony especially unique today and hopefully compelling is I am probably the only licensed provider who has spent 25 of my 28 years working alongside a naturopath, meaning in the building with the naturopaths. I think we could all agree that spending 89% of your career alongside an allied health profession is going to give you a pretty strong opinion of them, and my opinion is favorable. I then added it up for the purpose of this testimony and have probably worked with a minimum of 10 NDs over my career, and never once have I thought there was any incompetence or worry about the care they were providing, and in fact, quite the opposite. I have the utmost respect for this profession and so appreciate the unique niche of how they can help my patients that I work with and need help with. I attribute much of my integrative knowledge to the shared knowledge of working with these colleagues. I would like everyone to appreciate the niche of ND care, of the care that NDs provide. Just as I am providing primary care, so are they. Just as I am diagnosing, ordering labs, referring to specialists, and creating treatment plans, so are they. Just as I am doing pap smears, women's health, and listening to the difficult challenges and stress in people's lives, so are they. Their training and background is extensive and in many ways far more comprehensive than mine as a nurse practitioner, someone with full prescriptive authority. As you can presume, there are some really sick and difficult patients out there in Anchorage. And as was mentioned earlier, often they do shun allopathic medicine. But to highlight some examples, people are dissatisfied often with allopathic care. Gut problems are a huge deal. They'll get referred to a gastroenterologist, get a colonoscopy or endoscopy, told it's fine, it's normal, and are sent on their way. Maybe someone has an autoimmune disease and is sent to a rheumatologist, and their insurance won't cover the expensive biologics, and the rheumatologist doesn't have much to offer except management of symptoms. Naturopaths often will dive into immune support and figure out what they can do to make their autoimmune disease easier. People have rashes. They get tired of applying steroid creams over and over and wonder what is going on with my rash. Naturopaths will dig in and figure that out. Another interesting example is mold exposure. Being in wet climates, there's a lot of mold, buildings and homes, and people do get sick from this, and allopathic medicine has nothing to offer. I'm highlighting these examples to help you understand the role NDs have in our healthcare system. An ND considers it their goal to really get to the bottom of the underlying cause of health issues and help people holistically. This huge breadth of knowledge creates a devoted clientele who want their care to be with only one person, and it makes sense for all the reasons you can imagine to avoid incurring extra healthcare costs of seeing another provider. As someone who's been in the healthcare community seeing complex patients with difficult healthcare issues, we do need NDs. They really do serve a unique and needed niche in our community. We're short of primary care providers as it is, and the services they offer are highly in demand. Getting more NDs to Alaska would help the complex patients getting the help they need. If I could say the words, trust me, I would. But instead, let me tell you that as an extremely pragmatic person and pragmatic provider, I have absolutely no reservations about their competence or training that give me pause. Granting limited prescriptive authority as requested in the legislation would allow NDs to practice closer to the full extent of their education and clinical training. Our first goal is to do no harm, and I firmly believe, again, based on 25 years of close working relationships with naturopathic doctors, that no harm will come to the public with them having limited prescription authority as they have already been trained to provide. In addition to my testimony today, I have a written letter of support for the committee aid to add to the bill file.
Thank you for your testimony.
Thank you.
We'll go online now. The first person in on the line is Bruce Campbell in Fairbanks. Bruce will be followed by Pam Ventigen. She is the executive director of the Alaska State Medical Association. So, Bruce, welcome. If you would introduce yourself for the record and give us your testimony.
Thank you, Chairman Giesel. My name is Bruce Campbell. I live in Fairbanks, Alaska, in District 33. And it's my pleasure to testify in support of Senate Bill 193. I believe this is an important update to Alaska's existing statutes regarding the practice of naturopathy. As an individual who receives naturopathic care, I'm first impressed with the lab and evidence-based considerations evaluated for my care. Naturopathy, I believe, focuses on underlying causes and effects. The second and most perhaps the more important aspect is the time spent explaining the linkage between the lab results to my individual case. The depth of explanation is important to me because it focuses my attention to changes needed for successful treatment, as well as side effects to observe and report. I do not feel rushed. As a different story, I had an arthritic hip replaced by a fantastic surgeon a few years ago, and he required patients to undergo training prior to surgery. We had to, for example, learn how to use an ice machine and why it would supplement and supplant use of more serious opioid pain medications. The training included my wife. She had to also learn how to be a care provider for home care, and it included a list of supplements, some of which were to be taken before surgery. Others were taken not to be taken for 2 weeks prior to surgery, and yet others were for after the surgery. And the surgeon encouraged us to share it with our regular physician, but please do not change the schedule unless the doctor had training in naturopathic medicine. And I thought that was fascinating because I had a naturopathic background I could share it with, and he agreed with and could explain in more detail why some supplements should not be taken before surgery and why some should and some afterwards. So the overall result was a very successful, I thought, surgery replacement, and I think I took maybe one opioid painkiller the day out of the hospital, and from then on, the acetaminophen was more than sufficient. So I want to thank you very much. I encourage do pass recommendation and to advance from committee. Thank you, Chairman Dean.
Thank you very much, Mr. Campbell, for your testimony. Next up is Pam Ventigen, Executive Director of the State Medical Association. She'll be followed by Clyde Jensen with the Alaska Naturopathic Medical Association. Ms. Ventigen, welcome.
Thank you, Chair Giesel. For the record, my name is Pam Ventigen. I'm the Executive Director of the Alaska State Medical Association, and we represent both physicians and physician assistants throughout the state. I would like to point out for the committee that the lack of real-time public comment by physicians is in no way indicative of the significant level of concern that physicians have about naturopaths' ability to safely prescribe medications. Most physicians are busy during the day seeing their patients. Their ability to interrupt their patient schedule, call into the Legislative Information Office, wait on hold for an indeterminate period of time. For me today, it was a little over an hour. And then to be allowed to speak for 2 minutes is unrealistic for a practicing physician who has a full load of patients. If you were a patient, you wouldn't want to wait that hour for your physician to be on hold on the phone. So I would urge the committee to read the emails and the physician comments that have been submitted to the committee. Naturopaths also claim that physicians are opposed to their expanded scope of practice, and this is misleading. Over the years, the physicians that I have worked with, we have spent many hours meeting with the naturopath, working on ways to compromise on bills to allow them to practice to the best of their experience and training. But we have on numerous occasions asked for them to give us a reasonable formulary to discuss, because even physicians don't feel comfortable prescribing all medications. There are many medications that are so specialized that it is only a physician specifically trained in that specialty that other physicians rely on their expertise to prescribe some of these specialized medications. So open, one-year supervision after graduating from naturopathic school and passing an exam does not seem significant enough or enough to establish safety for the patients in Alaska. Physicians understand and respect that naturopaths are alternative practitioners. They're trained in homeopathic, herbal, and supplemental methodologies. We respect that they have expertise that physicians don't have, and that they are a complement to the medical system and providers that are available to patients. Patients often do not understand the difference, though, between a naturopathic physician or a physician assistant and a physician. And so if they go to a provider, they think they're seeing a doctor, and when they report to a specialist and the specialist asks who they've been seeing and they give a name, then they find out that, in fact, that provider is not a physician. It is another either advanced practice provider or an alternative practice provider. So we have real concerns. We would like to continue working with the naturopaths, but we do not feel that this bill provides the safety necessary for patients in Alaska. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony, Ms. Venchin. And I do want to personally thank you for your desire and the working with naturopaths that you have been doing, the State Medical Association has been doing. The bill has been, I know, modified to comply with a lot of the requests. So thank you for that effort. Next up is Clyde Jensen. He's with the Naturopathic Medical Association. He'll be followed by Dr. Anu Mariam Pillai. Mr. Jensen, welcome.
Thank you, Chair Giesel. My name is Clyde Jensen. I have a PhD in pharmacology, and I've recently completed a 5-decade-long career in which I have led colleges of allopathic, osteopathic, and naturopathic medicine, and I've taught pharmacology to students in each of them. I have been asked to compare the training concerning drugs among naturopathic, osteopathic, and allopathic medical schools in an effort to be very brief and comply with the 2-minute guidelines that have been given. I'll just share a couple of very quick excerpts from a testimony that I have sent to you and then set for questions if you wish. Pharmacology instruction is delivered in the classroom in each of those three professions. And that's done during the first 2 years of medical school. And that pharmacology instruction is virtually identical. in each of those three professions in their medical schools. To elaborate, those students from each of those schools receive the same number of pharmacology contact hours, study the same drugs, use the same textbooks, are taught by faculty with common credentials, are evaluated using similar examinations, and introduced to the same pharmaceutical standards of care published by the major allopathic specialties. Another type of drug training I'll spend less time on is clinical observation, and here there are some departures between what naturopathic physicians or students receive and what MD and DO students receive. And the reason for those departures is that naturopathic students are spending more time studying the herbal, nutritional, and other modalities that were mentioned by our previous presenter. That difference in this bill is intended to be mitigated by the year of collaboration that naturopathic physicians are expected to have before prescribing drugs with MD and DO physicians who have had more prescribing experience in their residencies. The third area of comparison is continuing medical education. And I personally, as well as have other pharmacologists, delivered training after MDs and DOs and naturopaths have graduated from their respective medical schools concerning new drugs that have come onto the market. And my observation is that continuing medical education is equally effective in training MDs, DOs, and naturopaths. And that will conclude my statement, and I'm happy to remain and answer any questions if you wish.
Thank you very much, Dr. Jensen. You reminded me that, of course, doctors of osteopathy, otherwise known as DOs, for a long time were not recognized as legitimate equal to an MD. They are certainly now, and seems to be working out. Thank you for your testimony. We'll move on now to the next testifier, Dr. Anu Mariam Pillai. I'm certain I'm not pronouncing that correctly. Following him will be Thomas Obermeyer. Dr. Anu.
Yes, hi, thank you. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Okay, good afternoon. Thank you for having me. And thanks to all the presenters for their perspective on this very important topic. My name is Dr. Anu Mariam Pillai. I'm the medical director and the cancer center, medical director of Alaska Native Medical Center in Anchorage, Alaska. I've been here for at least 7 years, and I have quite a bit of experience treating cancer patients in our state. I agree with some of the terms with relating to a lack of access to care in Alaska, which has been an ongoing issue for many years. With regards to naturopathic doctors and their scope of prescription, I would like to have some concern over the prescription privileges, mainly based on my experience with our very sick cancer population. I have often seen confusion with our patients between what a naturopathic doctor does and an osteopathic and allopathic doctors do. And oftentimes there is a conflict of recommendation and medical advice on what to do next. I do worry that the prescription ability will confuse the patients more and lead to a disconnectedness in continuity of care for some of our patients. For example, I've had a patient come in with an early stage cancer who had opted to see her other doctors, and the other doctors were naturopathic doctors elsewhere, and unfortunately did not get the standard of care chemotherapy and returned several months later with stage 4 incurable disease. Now, I understand that chemotherapy is not going to be part of the responsibilities that they are seeking, and as you know, those are very complex therapies. But supportive care medications are important. There is a lot of changes with the new medications that are coming out, a lot of interactions. And it takes years of training and residency and clinical bedside manners to become proficient in them. Our medical training is 4 years of medical school, but at least 3 years of residency and another 3 years of fellowship before, continuing to be independently practicing. And we have every 10-year board exams that are vetted and CME as well. I'm sure the naturopathic field has their own credentialing processes, but the prescription portion of it can be very confusing to patients. So that is my thoughts on it, and I'm willing to take questions as well.
Thank you very much for your testimony. I don't see any questions. Next, we'll move to Thomas Obermeyer, calling in from Anchorage. He'll be followed by Dr. Scott Looper. Mr. Obermeyer, welcome.
Yes, can you hear me?
Yes.
Oh, okay. Senator Geisel, you may remember I worked as legislative staff for Senator Betty Davis on the same bills that come up periodically with the naturopaths trying to expand their scope of practice. And I am concerned about the bill, not necessarily on the continuing education section, which since House Bill 147 has been reduced from 60 to 30 hours, because 15 hours should be enough a year. I think that is to maintain my oral license. But I would say that the language of the bill concerns me because the amount of supervision that I think the Department of Commerce, Community, and Economic Development will provide will be fairly limited. Asking the supervising physician to keep track of what's going on for a year with the naturopath, and then to give them a free rein after a year if they think that they've been performing well. One of the problems, of course, is that the language is very vague. When you talk about preventative and therapeutic purposes for administering prescription drugs, that is so general, it could go over hundreds of drugs, many of which are coming out every day or being renamed or being advertised on TV. And I don't know that anyone really would feel that this is something that they should be doing. Although the previous speaker said they get pretty much the same training, I would point out that the experience of a physician who has many years of residency, 3 to 7 to 10 years, after medical school, after graduation from college, is going to be better trained to look into the diagnostic and disease area that allopathic medicine is primarily involved in. Naturopathic medicine, of course, was involved in herbal medicines that has kept creeping into other areas. And I see the connection between the two, and I understand the concern about bringing people in and then finding there's a problem that they need a drug. The thing that maybe diabetes could be treated easily with 3P medicines and so forth, these can be fairly complex medical matters that they may not be experienced and trained in. So I would object just to the language of the drafting of section 845.33 and 34, and then subsection 34, section B, regarding just generically saying preventative and therapeutic purposes, prescription drugs. I just, there's so many drugs out. I think this is just overreach, and I think it could possibly be reined in. And I do question one last thing. I would question the supervision area, because when I essentially drafted and pushed forward the nurses' overtime bill, we asked that the hospitals provide detailed information on every subgroup so we could keep track of the hours, and they were being overworked in surgery and so forth. And the hours that they turned in were just dozens of generic hours every quarter. You couldn't separate them, and they were responsible for it, and you don't get it. So I would question really how much supervision would be provided here, and whether or not you should have some kind of a list that could restrict the usage of these drugs.
Thank you for your testimony, Mr. Obermeyer. Next up is Dr. Scott Looper. He'll be followed by Shannon Braden. Dr. Looper, welcome.
Thank you, Chairman Giesel. I appreciate you having me, give me the time to testify today. I practice here in Fairbanks, Alaska, and I am speaking in support of Senate Bill 193. I appreciate, I listened to the testimony, I appreciate the warmth and support of the testimony so far, that there seems to be a pretty universal agreement in the value of naturopathic care to patients in the state. I do want to mention that I did see a cancer patient today, the second to last patient I saw today, and I convinced her to get chemotherapy. I think that chemotherapy is going to be the best treatment for her, increasing her chances of survival from the thyroid cancer that she has. And it's interesting how many people come and are resistant to allopathic medicine, and she's absolutely one of those. She really is afraid and doesn't trust them. And the fact of the matter is I am in a position to be able to speak in favor of getting the appropriate medical care overall, and do so routinely. And really, I see myself accurately as a member of the healthcare team here in Alaska, where we all work together. We all have different skills, we have different aptitudes, we have different points of view, but we respect one another and we work together. So the opposition to Senate Bill 193 confuses me to some extent, because I know as a team member, because I've been on teams, basketball teams and other teams, my job was to build up my team members, was to do everything I could to get the best game out of them. The fact of the matter is we have a group of well-trained, competent, safe-practicing practitioners in place already here in Alaska who are being held back from providing their best care, to be able to, you know, appropriately prescribe things that a primary care doctor would prescribe for infections and high blood pressure and thyroid and those kinds of things. And to fully recognize that it's our job as team members of the overall medical team here in Alaska to refer to those specialties when appropriate. So I guess I want to say in a kind of an odd way that I wish that the State Medical Association asthma would quit hogging the ball, and that they would recognize that an assist is just as good as scoring a point when it comes to, you know, winning the game. We're all in this together. I realize that's an odd way of putting it, but it really is the fact that we are working together, and I do hope that your efforts to pass this, to support this, result in our being able to provide our best care to our patients here in Alaska. I'm willing to take any questions that they might have.
Thank you for your testimony, Dr. Looper. Next up, we have Shannon Braden. Shannon will be followed by Joe Kutchel. Shannon, welcome.
Thank you so much, Chair Giselle. Can you please tell me if you can hear me?
Yes, loud and clear.
Great, thank you. So, Chair Giselle and members of the committee, my name is Shannon Braden. I appear before you today as a board member of the Federation of Naturopathic Medicine Regulatory Authorities. The Federation, or FNMRA, is an association of state regulatory authorities that oversee the licensure of naturopathic doctors in the U.S. Alaska is a member of the Federation. The FNMRA submitted a formal letter of support for SB 193, dated February 17, 2026. as you have been hearing some concerns today about naturopathic doctors obtaining limited prescriptive authority under SB 193, I'd like to highlight the objective data that the Federation letter shows about how safe the practice of naturopathic medicine with prescriptive authority has been. So specifically, as an example, in the state of Oregon, which has had broad prescriptive rights for over 14 years, we calculated over a 7-year span of time the following: to compare naturopathic doctors, allopathic physicians, MDs, and doctors of osteopathy, DOs. So we calculated the percentage of licensees. So this negates the difference of numbers of practitioners. We calculated the percentage of licensees who received disciplinary actions. So in other words, what portion as a percent of all licensees have been subject to disciplinary action? MDs had 11 times the number of disciplinary actions compared to naturopathic doctors. DOs had twice the number of disciplinary actions compared to naturopathic doctors. So objectively, we can demonstrate the safety of naturopathic doctors practicing. If you'd like to see those numbers, they're in Addendum A on page 5 of the Federation's letters of support. So now let's speak specifically and drill down to look at only the disciplinary actions that were taken for reasons of inappropriate prescribing. So if you'll refer to the table in page 3 of the Federation's letter, between 2010 and 2024, that's a 14-year period of data, in the states where naturopathic doctors have broad prescriptive rights but are barred from prescribing controlled substances like opioids, there were 0 disciplinary actions. So again, I say there were 0 disciplinary actions taken against naturopathic doctors for inappropriate prescribing. This is the level of prescriptive authority that SB 193 would extend to Alaskan naturopathic doctors. This is objective, real-life data suggesting that the same safe results will be achieved in Alaska. Again, considering there's a 2-step process where there's first collaborative agreements and then secondly, independent prescribing. So in closing, the provision of primary care by thousands of licensed naturopathic doctors in the United States and other states has proven itself to be safe. Proven by over a decade of data. In states where there's broad prescriptive authority, the safety record is stellar. And I am happy to remain on the line for questions.
Thank you very much for your testimony, Ms. Braden. Next up is Joe Kutchel calling in from Fairbanks. Welcome.
Yes. Hi, my name is Joe Kukli, and I am a retired attorney, and I practiced law for 37 years in Alaska. And I just want to say, as a concerned citizen about the availability of healthcare and for what I would consider routine matters, I think that it's important for naturopaths to be able to practice and to be able to prescribe. And my understanding of Senate Bill 193 is it's very limited in what they are going to be able to prescribe. Recently in my life, I have a 92-year-old mom, and I go with her regularly to her doctor appointments. And it's fascinating to me how her nurse practitioners and PAs can prescribe. And I myself have had need to go to physicians and nurse practitioners outside. Very difficult to see a doctor anywhere, frankly, an MD. And, you know, they prescribe, the nurse practitioner can prescribe, the PA can prescribe, and they have less education than naturopaths. And so it's a little odd to me. The naturopaths who have very similar training in pharmacology to MDs don't have the same prescriptive rights, and this bill doesn't even give them the same prescriptive rights. It gives them very, very limited prescriptive rights. I think about people in Alaska who have to wait months to get a doctor's appointment, people in rural Alaska, and who may need, you know, antibiotics for a sinus infection. How frustrating that must be, and to not be able to have that ability. The other thing I just wanted to mention is that, you know, I think I look back at my own life and I can remember arguments about chiropractors and osteopaths and the American Medical Association and doctor groups, who I think have very limited constituencies that they represent, have taken, you know, a position against all of these other type of medicines. And yet we've seen medical advances in osteopathic care. I now go to an osteopath who is just as good as any medical doctor. But back 40 years ago, they were described as quacks. How many people go to a chiropractor? The American Medical Association and doctors took a very similar position to chiropractors. The chiropractors sued them and won, for crying out loud, because of actions that the American Medical Association has taken. So I worry as a citizen of Alaska about the availability of care, and any time I think we can get more care is better. And I just worry that this is sort of the playbook of the doctors' associations to try to prevent other forms of medicine to be considered. And they have a history of doing this, and I'm skeptical of that history. So thank you.
Thank you very much for your testimony. Last up is Dr. Natalie Wiggins calling in from Anchorage. Dr. Wiggins?
Good afternoon, Chair Giesel and members of the committee. Thank you so much for revisiting this bill. I'm here today in support of Senate Bill 193, representing the Alaska Association of Naturopathic Doctors. Chair Giesel, I wanted to take a moment and ensure that your previous question about malpractice insurance cost was addressed. In our investigations about this, we learned that MDs pay anywhere from about $1,200 to $5,700 annually versus primary care family practice MD physicians who pay anywhere from $7,500 to $20,000 annually. And this is for comparable coverage, $1 million per incident, $3 million total. So these numbers reflect the fact that there are far fewer claims made against ND providers than MD or DO providers. And we also just heard that testimony from Shannon Braden to this regard. I also wanted to share a bit more about my experience practicing medicine in Arizona, where there was this really refreshing approach. It was one that focused squarely on the patient and what best served their needs. So care was collaborative, and different types of providers worked within their training to help patients access timely treatment. In Arizona, my credentials used were NMD, naturopathic medical doctor, and I was referred to as a physician. And I can assure you that none of my patients confused me with their NDs or DOs by using these credentials. In Alaska, neither of these terms are used. And in Alaska, again, my patients have no confusion about the differences between my care and their ND or DO. At times, it can feel like some of the objections to this legislation are rooted in ego and concerns about professional boundaries. And I want to be really clear that naturopathic doctors are not trying to replace MD physicians or practice outside of our role. Our goal is simply to care for patients within the scope of the training we have received, focusing on the patient and not ego. Alaska doesn't need a medical turf war. It needs more trained medical providers with prescriptive authority, and naturopaths are here for this. Dr. Benson mentioned concerns about using medications that we are not trained to use. stating that specialized medication should only be prescribed by specialists, which she says MDs understand. Well, to be clear, this is something that naturopaths are also trained to understand. In attempts to bridge gaps in the medical community, I've been in conversations with Dr. Ian Fink, and I've reached out to individuals who are associated with the Alaska State Medical Association. The latter have yet to communicate with me. In Alaska, I often feel like I have to practice medicine with one hand tied behind my back without access to the tool of prescribing, and it puts patients in a precarious position of trying to navigate the overburdened healthcare system to get their needs met. The safety profile of ND prescribing is clearly illustrated in other states. Ultimately, this legislation is about allowing qualified naturopathic providers to practice within our scope of training so patients can receive timely, coordinated, and safe care. And I'm going to stay on the line in case there are any questions.
Thank you for your testimony, Dr. Wiggins. That is the last person signed up to testify today. Is there anyone further in the room that wishes to testify? With that, I will close public testimony. At this time, we're going to set the bill aside for further consideration. At this time, I'm making two amendment deadlines. The first one is for this bill itself. The amendment deadline will be next Monday, not February 9th. Pardon me, March 9th, March 9th at 12 noon. The second bill with a amendment deadline is Senate Bill 206, School Suicide Policies, Firearm Storage. And that amendment deadline will also be Monday, 12 noon. So the next meeting of this committee will be March 10th, Tuesday. During that meeting, we're going to have a presentation from the Planned Parenthood Alliance Advocates, and there'll be three bills up for consideration. Senate Bill 193, naturopaths, this very bill. Senate Bill 206, School Suicide Policies, the other one with an amendment deadline. And Senate Bill 272, Health Information Exchange. So with that, the agenda is concluded. Let the record reflect we are adjourning at 4:47 p.m.